Please note that the information and advice provided via the Things I Forgot Were Good For Me podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed or substituted for professional medical advice, counselling, or any other type of therapy or professional advice. I do not provide specific medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. And if you have any concerns about a medical condition, please consult with your GP or other qualified healthcare provider. Please do not disregard professional medical advice or delay seeking it because of something you've heard whilst listening to this podcast. Hi everyone, I'm Rada.
And I'm Giles.
And we're your trusted guides for the Things I Forgot Were Good For Me podcast. The podcast that helps you remember, relearn, rediscover and be inspired by others about what might help you feel good on this journey that we call life.
And we're starting right now on our journey to discover those things you forgot were good for you and inspire you to remember them. So without further ado, let's talk about this week's theme. Well, hello and welcome to a very special episode of Things I Forgot Were Good For Me, which is a podcast all about how we remember, relearn and be inspired by others. I'm here with my co-host, Dr. Rada Mogdiel. How are you?
I'm good, thank you, Giles. Yeah, it's lovely to be here. I'm very excited for this special for KindFest. This podcast episode is going to be all about something which you might have already spoken about on this festival, which is kindness. And as Giles said, we are now in almost our fourth series of our podcast, Things I Forgot Were Good For Me, which is all about those things that we knew maybe when we were little, when we were growing up, but gradually have got squeezed out maybe of our consciousness, or maybe we've been told that, you know, we don't need to necessarily concentrate on those things. So we are all about reminding you and learning from other people about what they find is good for them and how we can all live healthier, happier lives. And one of those aspects is kindness. And we've got a very, very special guest with us today. We are so delighted to have him. Honestly, I've heard of his work for years and years, but I've met him last year and I was absolutely inspired. Every single time I speak to him, I'm inspired by him. So I'm going to introduce our special guest. We're going to have a chat for about 50 minutes, all about his work, his journey, and most of all about kindness. So without further ado, who is our guest? Well, he's Professor Lord Layard. He's a labour economist who's worked for most of his life, actually, on how to reduce unemployment and inequality. He's also one of the first economists to work on happiness. And his current interest is how better mental health could improve our social and economic life. He's founder director of the LSE Centre for Economic Performance, and he's a co-director of the Centre's programme on community wellbeing and has written many books, one of which my microphone is actually leaning on at this present time. So without further ado, I want to introduce Richard. Richard, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's lovely to be with you. And I must say, I have learned from you, Rada. So this is a wonderful chance for us to talk.
Thank you, Richard.
Yeah, Richard, it's great to see you. Thank you so much for being with us. I wanted to start, if I may, with quite a sort of quite a big question, and I want to ask you about business and mental health. I know you have a background in economics, and it feels like with a bit more kindness and better well-being provisions in the workplace, for example, could our economy benefit from that more, and obviously subsequently our society? Would that be a fair assessment that at the moment there isn't possibly enough well-being provision in employers, by employers and business?
Absolutely. You know, one of the most extraordinary findings of this new science of well-being is when people are asked to make a diary of the previous day, or they're bleeped during the present day, and they say how happy they were at different times of day. Guess what the worst time of day is? Both in Britain and America, it's when you're with your boss. I mean, this is a deeply awful reflection, isn't it?
Yeah.
On this, the philosophy of management that's being put out by our business schools and our management schools, the person that should be inspiring you and appreciating you is pulling you down. This is something that's got to change. It's part of, I would say, a basic, actually much more important culture war than the one that people normally think of as culture wars. I think there's a huge distinction between two cultures, one of which is extremely macho and leads to that outcome, and the other is more tender-minded and based on encouraging people to help and support each other. So I think what you said is absolutely right. We need a revolution at many workplaces where, number one, of course, the business has got to accept that its only obligation is not to the shareholders, it's also to the workers. That has been remarkably accepted by, for example, the US Business Roundtable issued a statement 3 years ago saying that they felt that it was wrong to say that the only responsibility of business is to the shareholders. So how are we going to get a better life for workers? It's about a quarter of people's waking time, and it should be a lot better than it is. So number one, I would say, measure the well-being of the workforce and see if you are improving it or driving it down. Because, you know, if the only measurement is the bottom line, there's no other measurement, you don't get the balance and the perspective. But two, I would say, actually, the most important thing is to get the right people appointed as team leaders. These bosses are very, very important to everybody's happiness. And when people leave, we know that people don't leave their job, they leave their boss. That's what makes people leave jobs more than anything else. So appointing team leaders who are skilled to inspire people and not just to organize them in a technical sense. I would say that I put that number one. Number two, I would say, organize teams in a way which give team members a proper say in how the work is organized so that they can both contribute to the work being organized in a way that is, makes sense in terms of their own lives, work-life balance, etc., but also, of course, make sense in terms of doing the work effectively. And there's a very good experiment called the STAR experiment, which was led out from MIT, where this approach was facilitated. And it had dramatic results. It cut quitting, for example, by a third, which is something that any business would very much like to do. Then I would say, have a look at pay, because I think that team spirit is one of the most enjoyable things, a positive team spirit. You sit on the football field, why don't you see it more at work? If you insist every year in ranking the members of the team, the top 10% get something and then the next 80% and the bottom 10% get nothing or even required to go. I mean, if you're ranking people who are meant to be cooperating with each other, that is not going to produce much cooperation and certainly not much enjoyment. So I think that's very, very important. And then there's the whole attitude to mental health. Obviously, a lot of mental health problems show up at the workplace. Some of them are generated at the workplace by what we've been talking about. Some of them come from outside, but they show up there. And every team leader should be comfortable to say to a colleague, are you okay? And if they are not, to have an open discussion, what is the nature of the problem? We know that there are various ways in which you can get help, either from the employee assistance of in the company or from state services, such as we have within the NHS. They should know all about that. And then they should also, of course, have a proper system for reintegrating people when they're ready to come back, assuming that they had to take time off. Often do it in a step-by-step way, and just have an open, matter-of-fact approach to mental health problems. Almost everybody has a mental health problem sometime in their life. We should be able to talk about it, just as we can talk about a broken leg. And if we had this kind of open attitude, I think we've got a real way of supporting and helping people through their problems. Funnily enough, yesterday I was at the Bank of England talking to their mental health network. I think these mental health networks in organisations are extraordinarily valuable, both in representing that side of the workers' interests to the management, but also in having peer support groups and generally promoting the idea that this is a straightforward, matter-of-fact thing, that part of life, and we can talk about it.
Mm. That's really fascinating. I think you raised so many good points in there. I mean, I'm really interested in kind of how we've gone wrong, as it were, and how we're correcting ourselves. Because I think, you know, I believe a lot in the wisdom of young children. I think young children innately know, you know, most of the time how to be with each other. We talk to young children a lot about kindness, the importance of kindness. And actually, you see young children being very kind without even being need to be told, for example. What do you think happens between that being a priority for children and to teach children about kindness in terms of our adult sense of the word? What happens between that and then, as we kind of grow up and we become adults, that the priority for kindness is almost forgotten about, or it's almost pushed down? What do you think is has happened there? Because obviously, as adults and teachers and in society, we're telling young people, we're telling children, be kind, be empathetic, you know, this is how we can help and support each other. But then as we grow up ourselves, it's almost like we need to relearn those lessons in our adult world. Why do you think we see kindness for children as a priority, and yet we don't necessarily see it as a priority when we become adults?
Well, I think one of the obvious problems is the degree of competition that we force on children. If you tell a young person that their duty, their prime duty in life, is to themselves, to quote, make the most of yourself, to do better than other people, I mean, that is an absolutely hopeless philosophy for a society and for the individuals in it. Because if you think of it from the point of view of the group, if one person does better, somebody else has to do worse. So it's what you could call a zero-sum philosophy for a society. And yet this is what increasingly teachers are encouraged to say to their children. You know, if you don't do this or don't do that, you won't do well enough in your exams, you won't get a high enough income, you won't get a good job, nobody will be proud of you, etc. So I think we've got to get away from that set of values that is running right through the school system to a set of values which are positive sum, in the sense that people get the purpose that people have is to contribute to the well-being of other people and to get their own satisfaction from doing that. How can that be done? Well, I think we need actually a proper ethical system in our culture. We don't really have an ethical system at the moment. The old ethical systems that were associated with religions are largely not accepted, because the religion is not accepted, and there's a sort of void. And into that void, I think very naturally, goes egotism. Because I think what you say about young children is absolutely true. They've got a very kind, altruistic side, and they've also got a very selfish side. And human nature is like that. It's like that for evolutionary reasons. You know, if you don't take care of yourself, you're not going to leave any successors. But equally, the human race has prospered because people do also have this impulse to collaborate. And really, it's the job of the educational system and the social system as a whole to support the altruistic side in human nature, rather than to egg on the egotistic side. And I think there's a terrible tendency, I think maybe economists are partly responsible for encouraging it, to say let's exploit the egotistic motive as far as possible in order to achieve results. So people, of course, they don't even think of what is the desired result other than economic success. So then they say, well, you know, if we encourage people to compete, they'll become better engineers or whatever, and we'll have a higher GDP. That's not really an important outcome as compared with whether people are enjoying their lives. So the ethic, we need a different ethic. What is the measure of success for a society? I think you have to start at that point. Before you go into how do we motivate individuals, think what do you want for the whole group of people in society. And I think that the measure of success of a society is that people enjoying their lives, feeling satisfied, fulfilled. And if we could have agreement on that, we could then say, well, how do we get to that? Well, obviously, we get to that. And this is the great insight of the Enlightenment, the 18th century Enlightenment, my hero, Jeremy Bentham, saying, if that's the objective, to have a society that provides happiness and satisfaction to its members, then what should be the goal in life of each of the members? Well, it should be to contribute to that society. Mm. It should be to try and create as much happiness as we can in the world. Now you and I rather belong to Action for Happiness, and that is the pledge that members of Action for Happiness make, that they will try in their lives to create as much happiness as they can and as little unhappiness. It's a wonderful basic way of thinking and, of course, feeling that can guide you through life. And I think that that should be the message that the schools are giving to children. Not that you've got to do as well as possible, but you've got to make yourself into somebody who can contribute and, of course, do it day by day as a child. So I think that we are in a culture war between that macho culture that we also saw at work, but we also see in schools everywhere, it's being pushed on us, to a cooperative and loving culture.
Richard, sorry, Rada. I was going to say, it sounds to me a little bit like this is more prevalent in the capitalist societies, the Western societies. Would that be fair that these kind of issues are possibly more prevalent in capitalist societies? You've talked about kind of that one-upmanship and the goal to make the most money, have the nicest houses, blah, blah, blah. Is that what is driving a lot of this unhappiness in our society?
Well, I wouldn't want to comment on the formerly communist countries or China. What I think I would like to comment on is the differences amongst capitalist countries, because from the Gallup World Poll, which surveys the happiness of people in every country in the world every year, and the results are published in the World Happiness Report next March, is the next issue. From that, we know that the happiest countries in the world are not necessarily the richest. They are mainly the Scandinavian countries, where the way in which children are brought up is just so much more to look for the things which they have in common with each other, rather than to try and find a way of showing how different and special each of you is. And so and that then influences everything else in life, how people behave, of course, what government services there are, what the distribution of income is, and so on. So I would say that the more equal and the more respectful societies are the happiest. And you can see this in these fascinating experiments where wallets are dropped in the street. This has been a lot of this being done now, you know, with money in them, but with an address in the wallet. And you see how many of them are returned. So in the Scandinavian countries, you find something like 80% get returned.
Wow.
In the rest of Europe, it's more like 60%. And outside Europe, it's more like 40%.
Okay.
This is a huge factor that affects actually people's happiness. How pro-social and how empathic is the population? Because you return a wallet because you just know how much it hurt the person to lose it. Interestingly, Radha was talking about the sort of innate goodness of human nature. Here's a very interesting fact, which was tested in these experiments. The more money there is in the wallet, the more likely it is to be returned. Mm. Now, that's the opposite of what the economists would predict, because it then brings home to the person who finds it the pain that the loser must be feeling. So that is, as you started saying, rather, this basic goodness in people, which doesn't disappear, but it can get so overlaid with the pressures of competition. And of course, we know that social media that is adding to this pressure to show that you've got something better than anybody else has got. This is a very sad thing. And I think, you know, the experiments show clearly people are happier when they don't use Facebook. They're removed from that competition. And I think we're going to have to find a way of moving towards some sort of better use of social media than we have at the moment.
Mm, that's fascinating. I mean, I was contemplating about whether or not to drop my wallet outside, but I don't think I'll need to stuff it full of cash, which I don't have, so I won't do that. I won't have the fear of not being returned. It sounds to me, which is obviously one of the obstacles, because I think when we're talking about something like happiness and well-being, it's useful to talk about what it is, but it's also useful to think about the potential obstacles or blocks or challenges to that. Because I mean, I'm a big believer, and I think, you know, all of us are actually that are talking right now, that, you know, innately humans do want to help each other, they do want to support each other, they do want to be connected to each other. So what is it that comes up, or what challenges come in their way, or obstacles that make that less likely to happen, or make it more challenging for people to be kind? Because I mean, Giles and I did a podcast episode back in January with Houston Craft, who's done a lot of writing about kindness, and he was saying that kindness is actually a courageous act. It's something which sometimes takes a lot of courage to show, and to, I suppose, align your life with. It sounds to me as though one of those big obstacles to being kind or to showing kindness is fear. So fear of, like you say, not being good enough, competition, scarcity of resources, other people's opinions, perhaps fear of being abandoned by your tribe or by other people, or not being accepted. Do you think underlying all of the things we've spoken about, do you think it is fear that is the biggest obstacle or the biggest challenge to people being kind to each other or being kind to themselves?
Well, being kind to yourself is a different thing altogether. that's a really important subject, because obviously one of the greatest sources of unhappiness is excessive self-criticism. Maybe we can come on to that. But I don't think that most people are too embarrassed by being kind, if that's what you're saying. I don't think that's the problem, really. But I do think that what is needed is people feeling they belong to a group in which mutual support is the natural way of behaving, and people are very open with each other, and so on. And of course, that's very much what we are trying to create in the Action for Happiness movement. That, of course, you can get a great deal of wisdom about how to lead a happier life online and so on. But it's actually only if you meet regularly with people with whom you share these values that they become the norm.
I'm just going to pause you there, Rich, also get support from other members of the group. Yeah.
So I'm just going to pause you there
because I think some people who are watching may not know what Action for Happiness is. Now, you actually co-founded Action for Happiness. Tell everyone watching a little bit about what it is, what it does, and actually how you came to I suppose, create it with another couple of incredible individuals.
Well, going back to, I think it's now 13 years ago, we felt that there was a kind of moral void that because of the decline of religious practice and so on, people had lost whatever guidance they got from that and whatever comfort they got from it, and that we really need to get together regularly with people with whom we share our values, to be inspired and to be supported in living the way that we want to, but we don't always feel we can. And also to stop worrying about ourselves so much, to not be so obsessed with our own importance, because when you're with other people, you remember that you're actually not the only person who matters, which is how it often seems when you're on your own. So Action for Happiness is a movement for a happier society where people are offered wonderful materials online, but also offered the ability to get together in groups, first learning groups. So there's a wonderful course which has been trialed. It's now being called Happiness Habits, and it's been trialed and shown to raise people's happiness as much as finding a partner or getting a job from being unemployed. So this is a transformative thing, but its focus is on becoming happier through being kinder. That's the focus of it. And then the aim we have is that more and more of these groups will form themselves, and people will meet regularly around materials which the movement supplies with a sort of annual cycle around the 10 keys to happiness. So please have a look, anybody who's watching this podcast, at the Action for Happiness website. Please take one of our online courses, or preferably the courses called Happiness Habits, which are face-to-face, currently online, but face-to-face in a group, and then join a group, or you can just join a group. And I think that, you know, we will see that this is meeting a massive need people have to express their feelings and share their feelings about how life, you know, should be lived, and the way we are, we get perspective by meeting with other people and sharing our aspirations and being inspired. So if I can just say, Radha, since you didn't say it, Radha, we're very happy, has become a trustee of Action for Happiness, and is going to help carry the message far and wide.
Absolutely.
So you mentioned some of those keys to happiness, Richard. I wanted to ask you what happiness is to you. What does happiness mean to you?
Happiness means to me feeling good. That's a very simple concept, I think. It's quite interesting. When these people ask these questions, the question that's most often asked is, overall, how satisfied are you with your life these days? It's one of the questions which gets the most rapid reply. And people know how they feel. And actually, there's a lot of tests whether these people are answering the questions in a standard way, so that we can compare the happiness of different people. And this turns out to be just an extraordinarily meaningful measurement. For example, it is almost the best predictor of whether you'll still be alive in 10 years from now. Just how you answer that one question. So I think most people do know what happiness is. You asked me the question, what does happiness mean? I think people know what happiness is.
Yeah, wow, that's very powerful. Actually, I never really thought about it like that. It's more, I suppose we tend to think of sort of happiness alongside emotions, don't we? Sort of sadness or other kind of feelings. But I suppose actually happiness is an experience. It's something that it is an action, I suppose. And maybe we're thinking about happiness in a sort of a 2D way. We've been thinking about it in a two-dimensional way for too long. And maybe actually the action part of it is to transforms it into the 3D, where actually it's an experience. It's something we can actually, to some degree, take control over. Because I think obviously, a lot of the time when we think about happiness, people have got, you know, different challenges in their lives. It's, you know, life is difficult, all kinds of issues come up, all kinds of problems come up in life. And sometimes it can feel, I think for all of us on occasion, some more than others, that happiness is quite difficult to experience or difficult to achieve or difficult to kind of keep going. And I think there's a very famous quote about someone saying, you know, don't try, happiness is like a butterfly. If you try to catch it, it will escape you even more. It will become even more elusive. Do you think the pursuit of happiness is something which can cause, if it's pursued too much, can it cause unhappiness? And do we need to not necessarily focus on it as a goal, but more as an experience?
Well, I think it's very important to be clear, if we just step back to what is the aim of the whole process. We are interested in a society in which people are happy. So how do we get to a society in which people are happy? Obviously not by each person pursuing their own happiness. That would produce a pretty unhappy society. It's got to be a society in which people pursue the happiness of other people as well as themselves and get a lot of their own happiness from pursuing the happiness of other people. So, you know, self-obsession is, of course, the sure route to unhappiness. So the happiness philosophy, the philosophy of the greatest happiness as the measure of a success for a society, is not at all leading to the maxim that each person should pursue their own happiness. On the opposite, it's leading to the opposite, that we should exploit that altruistic side of our natures, and if it's the one thing that you've got, it's that if you want to feel good, do good.
Absolutely. Richard, now we've taken the government to task and the education system on this conversation. Obviously something that's a massive challenge for everybody at the moment is climate change. Is there something we can be doing within climate change to help harness things like the sun, you know, which could be beneficial to our well-being and happiness?
Well, the first thing is, why do we think climate change matters? And of course, it's because we think that the future generations matter as much as we do. Mm-hmm. That is a central element in the philosophy of well-being, which is not really present in the way that economics, for example, is normally practiced, where the future is felt to be much less important than the present. So we're worrying about the well-being of future generations. That's the first thing. Then the question is, what should we do about it? And the answer is lots of things, of course. Change our own habits. The thing which I have stressed, I don't know if that's why you asked this, the thing which I have actually stressed is the technological solution, because there's one absolutely simple thing that would solve the problem, and that is that if clean energy was very much cheaper than dirty energy, nobody would be wanting to buy dirty energy, and therefore there'd be no point anybody producing it. So I am a great believer and continue to be a great believer in the importance of basic blue skies research on ways to make clean energy cheaper. And I was involved for a time in what became called Mission Innovation, which has led to a doubling worldwide of expenditure on clean energy research. But it needs to be much more mission-oriented. I mean, if it was possible for one country to put a man on the moon in 10 years or to create an atom bomb in 5 years, it should be possible to solve this problem if we throw enough resources at it, and especially get the best minds engaged in it. So that's been my focus. But there are so many other things to be done, of course, including a massive amount of then of investment to implement whatever is found to be the most effective way of solving the problem.
And that just goes to illustrate, doesn't it, that obviously because happiness is such a wide-reaching feeling, I suppose, it's so related to our lives as a whole, that there are so many different elements that can bring us happiness and cause us unhappiness. So, for example, like you say, the climate, our environment, our community, our relationships, our workplace, our health, our physical health, for example. There are so many things like that. And also, one of the things I think which is potentially at risk or in danger of being being deprioritized, I suppose, is things like, you know, art and music and all of the things which really nurture us. Because obviously we all have our basic survival needs and they must be met first, but there are also so much kind of happiness that can be drawn from those other things that nurture our purpose and our direction in life and how we feel as human beings. Those kind of, often people think of those as sort of a higher level of need. But what do you think the role of arts, music, cultural activities are for our happiness as a society? Because sometimes people frame those as being nice if you can get it, or accessories, if you like, to the basic sort of needs of society and happiness.
Well, I think it's absolutely extraordinary. I mean, they used to be considered an important part of education. But somehow, because they're not an important part of a person's work life for most people, and people increasingly think that education is education for work, they've been downgraded. But education shouldn't be education for work. It should be education for life. And there's all the rest of life, when we have to find ways of rejoicing in all the different art forms. Some people have better music or enjoy music more. Some people enjoy using their eyes, and of course sport. Very important. All of it is a massively important part of most people's lives, and I think, you know, if you haven't learnt to look, for example, which is what really art classes teach you to do, you're missing out, because there's so much pleasure to be got in life from looking. Or if you haven't been taught to listen, if you don't really know how to listen to music, again, you're missing out so much. So I think it's a real, I mean, it's a kind of crime. It's just a complete... completely stupid decision to downgrade the priority of the arts. It's really incomprehensible how somehow the worship of the GDP has displaced the means to produce an enjoyable life.
Yeah, and I'll go on from that when you were talking about, you know, some of the happiest countries in the world being Scandinavian, and I know, like, for Finland, for example, poetry and music and art is taught at a very young age. You know, when children start school around the age of 6 or 7, obviously they start a bit older there as well, but they're introduced to to the arts and culture very early on. And again, goes back to your point of those societies being some of the happiest.
Yeah, yeah. We've got a lot to learn from these other countries for our school system and for our social services. I think they have, they treat, for example, care of the elderly as a much more prestigious and well-trained profession than we do. There's a lot, a huge amount we can learn.
Yeah. Richard, you talked a bit earlier on, or we were talking about self-kindness, which I actually find that harder than being kind to other people, actually.
Yeah, I agree.
I find that really tricky. I find it much easier to be kind to other people than I do to myself. And yet it's something which is so fundamental, isn't it, to our self-esteem, our confidence, our mental health, you know, how we view ourselves in the world. And also, I think, how much kindness potentially we can give to other people as well. But I'm really interested to get your views on what is self-kindness? What does that look like? But also how can we cultivate more of that? And why is it so important?
Well, the opposite of self-kindness is self-criticism. So, you know, every time one says something silly or does something silly, you feel awful for days after. And actually, there's one simple lesson which I've learned from one of our colleagues in Action for Happiness, which I think is a very, very good idea. If you're criticizing yourself, saying what a stupid thing that was, just think what a friend would say to you about it. And a friend would, of course, say, doesn't matter. So get out of your own mind, into the mind of your friend, and think what your friend would say about what you've done. Because a friend is certainly kinder, and is probably more realistic too, because a lot of self-criticism is actually, you know, not well-founded. So I think it is a very important thing, but this way of dealing with self-criticism, I think, is similar to dealing with all kinds of bad thoughts. And I think this is one of the great discoveries of the 20th century, you can influence your feelings by changing your thoughts. This is the basis of cognitive behavioral therapy from the 1970s onwards, that you are not the prisoner of your thoughts, including your self-critical thoughts. You can step aside from your thoughts, look at them, and don't necessarily suppress them or even totally dismiss them, but just step aside from them. Just observe them as phenomena, clouds going by in the sky, which don't possess you, and that creates the space to develop some more positive thinking and then that leading to positive action and positive feelings. So I think that this is a hugely important thing which has been discovered and proven again and again, of course, in clinical trials for depression and anxiety disorders. And it applies to the same principles that a therapist would apply to a patient are the principles you should apply to yourself when you're being self-critical.
Yeah, and it goes back to something you were saying also about social media and how that's probably exacerbated that to a certain extent, because we're always comparing. I call it comparing despair. You know, you're comparing yourself to other people and then you're sort of reflecting back on yourself a lot more. I'm not expecting you to know the answers to this, but what do you think we can be doing with regards to social media and how we can, you know, obviously there's people conduct themselves very differently sometimes on social media. Can social media companies be doing more, do you feel, and governments be doing more to sort of tackle some of the abuses of social media?
Well, I'm not an expert on this. I'll make one general point first, that all technological advance brings negative features as well as positive ones. So, for example, in Britain in 1930, car accidents killed 7,000 people. Well, we've got 100 or more times cars now than we had then, and we are only killing about 2,000 people on the roads because we have completely regulated the whole thing. In a way nobody then can have imagined. We've regulated the car, we've regulated the road, we've regulated the drivers. The whole thing, context, has been changed. And I have absolutely no doubt that social media will be covered in regulation in the years to come. But exactly what that will be, I'm not sure that I know. I mean, the thing which I think I do know is what schools can do. I mean, I think schools must, in their life skills lessons, which of course should be on a weekly basis, evidence-based, with teachers trained to do them, using materials which colleagues and I have trialled and other people, thousands of other materials have been produced, using evidence-based approaches, teach people how to, you know, what the dangers are, how to address them, both in your behaviour, how much time do you spend watching, do you participate at all in some of these things, how to react to the feelings that they give you, realise, for example, that, you know, everybody else, including yourself, is trying to show the best side of themselves, and you're always comparing the best of other people with the average of yourself. I mean, elementary errors that people make when they watch other people's social media. But it is a very, very, very difficult area, and I think the most extraordinary thing is that it obviously encourages showing off. And most societies, human societies, going back to the old Stone Age, have actually had quite a downer on show-offs.
Yeah.
you know, in primitive peoples, you get ostracized if you show off.
Yeah. You don't last very long.
And that's still true, face-to-face. People don't like people who show off or talk about themselves too much or whatever. And yet somehow different rules prevail online about showing off. Also, of course, about bad language and so on as well. I think, you know, human beings are very adaptable and they adapt to new challenges. As I said, they did with the car. So there will be a process of adaptation and some of the harms will be reduced.
Mm. Richard, I'm very interested in you as a person as well, because it strikes me that...
No.
It strikes me, well, you're always fascinating. You're always, whenever I speak to you, I'm always very inspired by your thoughts. But I'm also, I think, looking at your career and what I've read about it and having spoken to you before about how you got into the area of work you're interested in, it strikes me that you're someone who stepped back and saw the bigger picture. That, you know, lots of things tend to be in boxes, you know, work's over here and the economy's over here and health and well-being are over here. It strikes me that you through your work in terms of economics and looking at policy, you step back and you saw the bigger picture, actually how, you know, we were almost, things are turned on their heads, for example, like we were talking about before, that actually happiness and well-being needs to be the primary, sort of the first step, if you like, the foundation. And from that, everything else will come, like productivity at work, like good relationships, like society, you know, cohesion in society. It strikes me that you saw the bigger picture and started to obviously publish work and to look into that a lot more. Do you think that's an accurate summary of what you did? But also, I suppose, B, if so, what led you to be able to do that? And what led you to be able to see the bigger picture and start thinking about happiness in relation to productivity, the economy, and wider aspects of our lives?
Well, maybe the first thing to say is that when I was a student, I studied history, actually, but I read Jeremy Bentham. There was a paper on political philosophy, and that was a sort of light bulb moment. I mean, it seemed to me that this must be the right way of thinking about how we should try and lead our lives to contribute and how the government should be setting its priorities. And I didn't start as an economist. I became an economist when I discovered economics had been invented to try and discover the conditions for producing happiness in the population. The mistake was that they didn't take into account all the range of sources of people's happiness. Particularly after psychologists in the early 20th century were saying you couldn't know what was happening inside anybody. This was behaviorism. Economists jumped on the bandwagon and said, well, so we can only look at things that we can see and touch. And so it came that economists were thinking, all we can say about how a person's life is going, how well it's going, is what is their purchasing power. And that was a terrible mistake, and that's what led to this creation of the great god GDP. And I think one really important change has been that the psychologists have changed their mind. They now do think you can know what's going on inside people. you can listen to what they say and take it very seriously. In fact, we have to do that. We couldn't have a society if we didn't think we knew what was going on inside people. That's how human life works. Incidentally, it's also, of course, how physical medicine has always worked, by asking people how they felt. Economists somehow or other forgot that. That was one of the secrets of success of medicine. So we've now got the potential to have this wider approach to human flourishing. I'm just following along in the footsteps of these wonderful psychologists. Ed Diener, who unfortunately died a year or two ago, was really the pioneer who did this. And he was, of course, helped enormously by Daniel Kahneman, who then got the Nobel Prize. So this became a respectable body of knowledge, and I just joined in as an afterthought. And there were other economists who had worked on happiness earlier. Mm-hmm. By exploiting the vast, these very large scale surveys in which there's one or two happiness questions, whereas most psychologists have studied their own students or something, economists did make a contribution to the field by using these very big population surveys, from which, you know, I've learned, I've done a little research, but not a lot. You're right. What I have tried to do is to publicize it as a way of thinking about the future of society. Mm. And I do feel very passionately that we must get this view that the way we judge our society is by how extent to which people are enjoying their lives and feeling fulfilled and flourishing. Yes. And we've got to get away from, it is a form of materialism that leads people to think that somehow what the economy and what you can measure in money terms is the most important thing. We know, actually, if you look at the spread of happiness in the population and you look for the things which explain this very widespread, and we all know it from across the people we meet, the biggest single explanatory factor is mental health. Not self-diagnosed, but mental health as diagnosed by a clinician. Then obviously physical health matters also. Then human relationships in the family, at work, and in the community. And only third after health and relationships comes income as a factor explaining people's happiness. And I think it's really important to get this across. It puts the economy in perspective. Incidentally, it's also important for politicians to know this, because one of my colleagues has shown that the things that determine whether government gets re-elected are not mainly the economy, but how satisfied people are from all the things that are happening.
How people are feeling, emotional feelings and how people are feeling. Richard, we've run out of time, unfortunately. We can speak to you for ages.
Thank you so much. You're
fascinated on such a lot of work. It's fascinating. And if anyone wants to find Richard's more about Richard's work, then have a look at him online. Have a look at Action for Happiness. But I think from Giles and myself and everyone at Kindfest, we just wanted to say a big thank you to you for joining us today, but also for all of your work as well.
Yeah, thank you, Richard.
I don't think I've got it. Yes, here it is. I mean, if anybody wants to follow it up, can I just say that most of what we've been talking about is dealt with probably more articulately on paper here than the last time, but anyway.
No, it was fantastic, Richard. Real pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Lovely question.
Thank you.
Another Things I Forgot Were Good For Me podcast episode. Thank you so much for joining us. I hope it's inspired you to go looking for all of the things that might help you feel a little bit better.
And hopefully we've inspired you to go looking for our podcast. You can find it on all good podcast platforms, probably some of the bad ones as well. You can also find us on social media. Our handle is Radha.
Yes, Giles, absolutely. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Forgot Podcast. So go and find us there. We'd love to hear from you.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again next week.